case, which is case number 57274, Lyndon Harker versus State. David D. Lorimann as counsel for the appellant, and David brought his wife. Would you just stand up and Ms. Lorimann, thank you for being here with David. And we have Kirsty Pickering representing the respondent. Now, what I've asked, this is a little unusual, but we do this when we're with students. Ms. Lorimann, just tell a little bit about your side of the case. Ms. Pickering, tell a little bit about your side. If you each maybe do a minute, minute and a half, then we'll get into your actual legal argument. Ms. Lorimann?
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, may I address the...
Yeah, please do. Please turn your back, please.
I'm David Lorimann. I represent the appellant in this case, who is the defendant in a criminal action down in Ely. He was pled guilty to two counts in that criminal action, and then he went to sentencing. When we, as a part of the sentencing, we argued the factors that dealt with his life, which was called mitigation or mitigating factors. And the sentence came out that it was a sentence from the judge that in Ely, and that's what we are here today to discuss. To give you some background on Mr. Harker, he was in a family where at seven, he was force-fed drugs and alcohol by his older brother and sister. He went through life basically dependent upon drugs and other substances. He has a history of and issues of getting into trouble at a young age. His first crime recorded in the document that was submitted to the court was when he was 21 years old. He was never given any access or help prior to 1995 to any kind of rehabilitation regarding the drugs. But that program was something that's certainly not near what the programs are now. And what we had asked for the trial court is to recognize his life, his history, and that he be allowed to go through a drug rehabilitation program prior to any issue of sentencing and to help deal with the sentencing and the amount of time that he may or may not have spent in the Nevada state prison system. Those are basically the guidelines that we have come up with. What we're looking at today is the judge's decision on what he did sentence him to. Thank you.
Mr. Green, what about the state of Nevada? What's the facts that have you?
On average?
The facts of the case with regards to the state of Nevada. We are the prosecuting office, and we're located in Nevada, and when an individual commits a crime, we're the department that, in essence, prosecutes them, takes the case to trial, or tries to work out a deal with regards to that individual. With regards to Mr. Harker, the appellant in this matter, he was originally the defendant. And back March 18th, 2010, so a little over a year ago, the appellant, Mr. Harker, around 12:59 in the morning, very early in the morning, entered a convenience store in Nevada. He entered the store and he ordered the clerk of that store to give him the contents of that cash register. These are the facts of the case leading up to the charges he was ultimately charged with and ultimately pled guilty to, which ultimately leads us to where we are today. Initially, the clerk of the store looked at him like he was joking. He didn't know what to do with this individual. You know, you're in my store, what are you doing? Then the appellant again, Mr. Harker, said, give me everything in your drawer. Give me all the cash register. At which point, the clerk of the store became nervous. He became scared, and he went to the telephone and called the police. He also noticed at that point that the appellant, Mr. Harker, had a knife in his hand. At that point, Mr. Harker fled the store. He was ultimately located approximately 3 hours later in his motel room asleep. When approached and questioned by the officers, he admitted that he screwed up, he messed up, and yes, he did his own. He didn't have much of a memory of what happened. There's no question that he was drinking and using controlled substances that evening. He admits to that, and it's in the statements provided to the court. What followed after that was, obviously, he was arrested and he was taken into custody, and the evidence was provided to his counsel, and ultimately it was determined it was in his best interest to enter into what's called a plea agreement. That's where the defendant admits to what happened. We don't have a trial. There's no jury trial. Nobody's called as witnesses. It moves along fairly rapidly at that point. And the defendant pled guilty to two counts, one being assault with a deadly weapon. In other words, the individual, the clerk that he approached with the knife, that would be the assault with a deadly weapon, as well as the charge of burglary with a deadly weapon. In other words, he entered that convenience store with the intent to commit a robbery. And the state dismissed the charge of attempted robbery with a deadly weapon. That was the deal we gave him. And we agreed to not go forward on what's called a habitual charge. Habitual charge would be where the defendant has other prior felonies. And as the appellant alleged here today, the appellant, Mr. Harker, has been in the criminal system for some time. He has two prior armed robbery convictions. He spent time in prison for two previous counts, just like the one he committed illegally. He also has a third domestic violence conviction. In other words, he went to prison for committing domestic violence on his wife. Based upon all that information, which was provided to the court of sentencing, and what's called a pre-sentence investigation report, which is where parole and probation go through the life history of the defendant, they take into consideration alcohol abuse, drug abuse, prior criminal acts. I believe that the defendant had seven other misdemeanor convictions throughout his history, as well as three prior felonies. And those were all taken into consideration. And ultimately, he was sentenced. And the sentence was for two concurrent terms in prison. In other words, he would serve them both at the same time for both charges. And he was sentenced to 62 months to 156 months on the first count and 24 to 60 on the second count. So his minimal amount of time he could spend in prison, a little over 5 years. The issues that were discussed at sentencing by myself and counsel for the defendants are the issues that we're here to discuss today. Both the arguing with regards to what law applies and whether or not the trial judge, which is similar to our appellate judges here, but there's only one, and the trial judge makes a decision as to whether or not you are granted probation if you go to prison. Probation means you get to go to some rehabilitation, you have to abide by the laws, no drinking, no drugs, etc. Whether you go to prison and you take advantage of what the prison rehabilitation system has to offer. In this case, he went to prison, and that's what we're going to argue about today.
Ms. Pickering? The side will have 15 minutes. That doesn't mean they necessarily have to use up the 15 minutes, and during that 15 minutes, we have the right to ask questions to either side. We'll start off with Mr. Lorman for the appellant. Mr. Lorman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Cherry, Justice Pickering, Justice Gibbons, if it please the court, counsel. Today, what I bring forward is an issue where we have a situation with our sentencing that are we really doing the service that we need to in these types of cases? In the history that was identified in the appendix that has been delivered to the court, it shows that throughout Mr. Harker's life, he has not been given the opportunity, or the system has not helped him to overcome the fundamental issue that is causing these crimes. We haven't fixed the problem. We just seem to put him away and keep him away instead of dealing with what is the problem. The problem was presented to the trial court to show that Mr. Harker was suffering quite extensively from drug abuse. In fact, the court in its ruling, and I believe that is page 41 of the appendix, the court's ruling talks about there's no question, I feel you have a substance abuse problem. That substance abuse problem is the cause of it. And it was identified through the statement of Mr. Harker, all of the actions that have gone throughout his life.
Mr. Lerman, can I ask you a question on that?
Certainly, Justice.
Generally, to get maybe lesser treatment or drug court, and drug court's something generally if you complete where you try and kick the drug habit through a court-sponsored program, and if you succeed, you get a significant reduction in your sentence or maybe probation and all. So that's why I assume why you were making the request for Mr. Harker. But generally, to be eligible for drug court, you know, my understanding is that crimes you commit might be burglary, it might be theft of some type or even drug use, possession of drugs, but if there's any type of violence involved, like robbery or guns or things like that, they generally don't qualify for drug court. So your client, again, pled to a crime involving a deadly weapon. Can you tell us why you believe under the law that Judge Dan Pepez and Ely abused his discretion in not giving your client the opportunity to go to drug court because there was a weapon involved here?
I think the issue of going to drug court, yet there are some criteria regarding drug court and the violence issue. One of the things that we were discussing, and even though we petitioned for the drug court, that there's an alternative that he could put him into an in-house rehabilitation program and then determine after that program a sentencing structure based on his follow-through in that program, which that program itself would have been something that he had to pay for, not the state. In that regard, I think that the judge could have then given him the opportunity. One of the things that kind of emphasized in this, Justice, is that Mr. Harker began his life with the drug issue. I mean, he never had the opportunity not to have it. I mean, at 7 years old, he was going.
But you were saying you were proposing a program that he paid for himself.
Yeah, he was
as opposed to all of us in the room, the taxpayer.
Correct.
And normally, though, in drug courts, like when Judge Melville has someone who gets a speeding ticket and they get a fine, let's say, of $100 or something, some small portion of that fine goes to pay for drug courts, you know, like that. So taxpayers or speeders or people like that are paying for it. But you're saying here, none of us have been paying.
That is correct, Your Honor. The program that we were looking at was a program that he would be totally responsible for payment. There was availability for him to go in. The evaluator that does the evaluations for the drug court is that recommended that facility for this purpose.
Isn't there drug rehabilitation programs in prison, though? Couldn't he get sober, clean and sober in prison?
The problem that that we have, Your Honor, and this is one of the things that it seems to be where we drop off. One of the things that has been brought up is that Mr. Harker was just shortly released from prison for the domestic violence, but it was like he was dropped off. It was just there. There was nothing there for him. There was no, he wasn't on parole or probation or anything like that. He had no access to those benefits of kind of being in the system. When he got out, he had no way of coping with what had happened immediately after he got out. As the court is aware from the documents that have been submitted, we have a situation where his mother was diagnosed to pass away in a short fashion, and shortly after he got out, his unborn child died. So he was in a situation where, again, his mental state, he relapsed back to the only thing that he knew. And the programs in the prison don't give those follow-up programs outside. They don't continue. Whereas drug court, which is a fantastic tool that the courts have used, and I think that is shown great numbers of success stories, it's minimum two-year program, or you know, 1 year to two-year program, where these people are monitored and helped and guided and have a support system that can get them to this point where they can then function without the need of the drugs. And as we know, these drugs don't just go away.
Mr. Lerman, the way I understand the sentence, your Judge Lopez sentenced Mr. Harker to like 13 years in prison, where he's eligible to apply for parole if he as well in prison after about a little after 5 years. And if what you were suggesting is before the sentence be entered, that he participate in this program, and if he was successful, then maybe the judge would give him a lesser sentence.
Yes, Your Honor. And really from that sentence, the sentence is actually the maximum you can give in that case. The long end is 15 years, and the short end, that's 40%. Is the little over 5 years.
Well,
Well, if Judge Pepez had given him, like, probation instead of a drug court, what would happen if he had then violated the law again or slipped? What happens to folks that go to drug court like this?
If they violate the rules of the drug court, then they're subject to their penalty that they've gotten in their sentence, and they would go to prison.
There's a component here, though, that's troubling. Your client has a very, very long criminal history, and many of those crimes are violent, and that violence is visited on citizens. I mean, they are hurt, too, just as he was hurt by his family members as a child. My understanding from reading the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that in Florida, he was incarcerated, and he was actually put into a rehabilitation program in Florida. Is that correct?
It's my understanding in the case from 1995.
So at what point does the system say this privilege of going to drug court and having another chance at getting on the straight and narrow is reserved for people who are likely to succeed as opposed to people who have failed in the past already? At what point should the system draw the line, or do we keep hoping with everybody?
In this situation, in answering that, in the cases that came out of New Mexico and Florida, Mr. Harker was in his 20s, and he is no longer a young man.
He's in his 40s now.
He is 44, Your Honor, and it's something where that he is needs. He has to. I mean, he only has one more chance. I mean, he can't do anything more. He needs the ability to break away from this, and he needs that support. Now, even if he has a rehab system within a prison, you know, you're in a controlled environment. You're supposed to not have narcotics. You're supposed to not have alcohol. But that's the control. But when you're let out into the community where those things are pervasive, where's the control? Where we helped him on it? And I have to say, Justice Pickering, 1995 abilities in prisons for rehab, I think, is far and away overshadowed by what we have done in this last decade with all the drug courts and the awareness that the courts have come to know with the drug issues and all the issues with meth that we have, that we have really advanced ourselves in what's needed to help these people. And what I hate to see is a person that could be helped fall through the cracks because of the fact that when he was younger and he could have gone through this program, it wasn't available. But now, because of his history, he cannot access it. And so he's coming to this the situation where, you know, this is going to be, if anything, his last chance. He had to deal with some horrendous issues when he got out of prison, and there was nobody to help him. And he turned to alcohol and drugs again, which is everything that has been admitted in here. What I'm looking at, Your Honors, is the the sentence is just take it out of the parole and probation book, and that's the sentence. There's no change from it. What I submit, Your Honor, and it is the case that I cited in my fast track statement that talks about this, that the failure to use the discretion is an abuse of discretion. And in this case, I don't think that Judge Pepez actually used his discretion that he had to really look at this, because in the recommendation, it actually changes some of the facts that they presented earlier in their document. In the recommendation, it talks about him brandishing a knife. Well, as Ms. Pickering had stated earlier, the clerk saw the knife basically incidentally by moving back away to go get the phone. There was no sight. It was more of an inflammatory statement, I think, in that regard. And it seemed that they were focused on, you know, we're just we're giving up. We're not going to do anything for this gentleman, and that's it. And this is what we're recommending, which is basically all they could recommend. They couldn't go any further than that, as far as the sentence for prison.
Given his, excuse me, you go.
I noticed your client entered, like you mentioned, to the students an Alford plea where he didn't admit he did it, but he admitted that the state had enough evidence to convict him. Was there a reason he didn't make the admission that he did commit this offense? Because I know with drug courts, a lot of times they want you to admit your guilt and as part of the rehabilitation process. Then.
Your Honor, the reason I have to say that I was not trial counsel. I was appointed after the public defender's office had this case. That the reason for the Alford plea was because of his mental state at the time of the crime. The evidence showed, the video showed what happened, but he doesn't remember that.
See.
And so he could not truthfully say, I'm guilty of it, because he couldn't remember the specifics of what happened due to the drugs he had taken. He had taken 8 Clonopin.
Excuse me, what drug?
Clonopin.
What is that?
It's a... I believe it is an antidepressant or anxiety prescription. And so he was, his mind, and he also had alcohol, and so he did not know. And that's why he submitted the Alford plea for no contest on the crime, because he had actually was shown the video.
Okay. So. Himself on the video in the
correct.
Store.
Okay.
Is a person who commits a violent crime and violent, he pleaded no contest to having a knife and demanding money of a store clerk, does the statute that permits drug court allow for referral into that program where you've committed a violent crime and you have had the kind of record that this gentleman has?
I think the stance and the policy is that that would not be the case, that if you have that criminal history and the violent issues that they would not want the in a drug court. But that was also.
So were you asking Judge Popez to overlook the wording of the statute that creates drug court or that permits this process?
No, Your Honor. I was requesting that he would look at the possible of maybe suspension of the sentence at that point, or issuing sentence. And putting Mr. Harker into the in-house rehab treatment center, and then come back for sentencing.
You may.
Anyway, finish that rehab and come back for sentencing for a review with all the evaluations and the program that he went through and how he could succeed or not succeed, which would have given the court certainly much more information. As to whether to sentence him to the maximum or maybe lower the minimum and still keep the hammer there for his use to continue his life drug-free and alcohol-free. That was the only way he was going to be able to get out of the cycle.
Thank you, Mr. Lorman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Pickering for the State of Nevada.
Please, the court. Good morning. The appellant, Mr. Harker, committed 2 violent crimes, assault with a deadly weapon and burglary with a deadly weapon, and he was sentenced to prison by the sentencing judge.
Let me ask this question right off the bat. Governor Sandoval tells us that we're in financial trouble in this state. We understand as justices that it's about $23,000 to $25,000 a year to keep somebody in prison. And if this man was in drug court, and our drug rehabilitation was able to become drug free, let's see, he would have to register his car and pay money, he would buy things and pay sales tax, he would work, and that would create jobs probably and spend money create jobs for other people. Why won't the district attorney agree to drug court in this matter?
The district attorney and the state of Nevada would not agree to drug court in this matter, mainly because he is a violent criminal. He is a danger to society. In every county, every state he has resided in, he has committed violent crimes. When he resided in Florida, he committed armed robbery. When he resided in New Mexico, again, armed robbery. He comes to Ely, third domestic violence. Three counts of domestic violence, putting him in prison again, mandatory prison for domestic violence. This is not a man who is subject to change or rehabilitation. He has been given those opportunities. And if the court would permit me to point to the pre-sentence investigation.
That's what I was going to ask. If you, we try to make this somewhat of a learning experience, too. How does a district attorney and a defense attorney know all this background information about a man like this who's been all over the United States committing crimes?
Your Honor, the state is presented with what's called a pre-sentence investigation report, which is what's called a review of the defendant's life from the moment he turns 18 to the time of the conviction, the most recent conviction. It lists his marriage status, his children, his childhood, information that the appellant provides to the what's called parole and probation individuals who make this report, his mental history. In fact, it provides for his substance abuse history, whereby he informed parole and probation that he has not used controlled substances since 1995, in essence contradicting what he was telling the court when he came before them requesting drug court. An individual has to have an alcohol or actually a drug addiction in order to get into drug court. Individuals with alcohol addictions, there are other programs set up for them, for example, Vitality Center in Elko, 30-day program. Individuals with drug problems are in drug court, not alcohol. Here, the defendant said himself, I don't have a controlled substance problem. In fact, he was an inpatient program in Florida in 1995 after armed robbery, again, given that opportunity. The state receives all this information. The state also receives information showing his arrests and his dispositions from those arrests. And we start in 1988, right off the bat, strong armed robbery. He was given probation at that time. Then armed robbery, fugitive from justice, goes to New Mexico. Aggravated assault and battery, misdemeanor. Aggravated assault and battery, misdemeanor. We see him battery domestic violence. Prior to him coming to Ely, he has another robbery with a deadly weapon in Florida. Comes to Ely, domestic violence, domestic violence. In fact, he actually got a DUI in 2007, mandatory AA counseling and DUI school. Rehabilitation, things he did not take advantage of apparently because he continued to drink and commit violent crimes. February of 2007, DUI. June of 2007, domestic violence, third offense. Off to prison he goes again for, again, a violent crime. He gets released from that prison sentence for the domestic violence, and 6 months later, he is again drinking, abusing prescription drugs, and committing violent crimes. He's entering convenience stores with knives and, in essence, trying to steal the money from the store. He wasn't successful this time, and he fled. Luckily, the clerk called the police. I would like to also address some of the inconsistencies with regards to the appellant's argument, some of the facts.
Let me just ask one other question. If, in fact, when he was in high school, if he had committed offenses and been treated as a juvenile, do district attorneys and defense attorneys learn about juvenile records also when they do pre-sentence reports?
If they haven't been sealed, then certainly we would receive that information. Here we don't have any information as a juvenile. It does not appear that he got into any trouble as a juvenile, to the best of my knowledge, but we are certainly entitled to review that information and consider it.
So even juvenile offenses may follow somebody throughout their adult life, especially if they walk down the wrong path as far as law is concerned.
Exactly. There's 3 years in which those offenses can be sealed if the individual has a clean record. Other than that, oftentimes we see that people simply reoffend when they turn 18 and that record then becomes open.
You mentioned Anderson. Let's say this gentleman, I know he's older, but let's say he had been 17. Offenses occurred. He was like a senior in high school. How would he have been treated differently by the district attorney's office than he was since he was over 18?
If he was under 18, age 17 at the time, and assuming that the state did not consider these offenses to be so egregious to try to prosecute him as an adult, then he would be subject to the juvenile system. A juvenile master would hear the case, and most likely, assuming it was his first offense, even if it was a violent first offense, he would be sent to some of the institutions we have in the state of Nevada, such as China Springs, where there is a rehabilitation offered. There are other programs more specific for drug rehabilitation if that doesn't work, and they're placed on probation. Some programs last 6 months, some last up to 18 months, and simply because the individual turns 18, during the time that they're on juvenile probation does not mean they are released from probation. They would still be under the supervision of our office and juvenile probation with regards to that case.
So my understanding is if you're under 18, you could be sent to China Springs, which is in Douglas County, for boys, and Aurora Pines for girls that commit offenses. So there is but they would be transferred from Ely all the way over to Douglas County by the Western Nevada for that. But there are some offenses, like you mentioned, that are automatically, even if you're, let's say, 14 or 15, if like a murder or sexual assault, things like that, you're automatically tried as an adult regardless of what age you are.
Correct. Right? The statute does not actually give us that leeway to charge them any other way. Some offenses where, for example, this say the appellant has began committing offenses when he was 12 and committed offense. After, say, the fourth crime, we could certainly move to have him charged as an adult at that point. If the individual went through rehabilitation programs and was not receptive, was not learning the tools that were provided to him, then we would certainly send him to what's called NYTC, which is the Nevada Youth Training Center. I believe there is it's in essence jail. They go to jail. We give up. We have no further tools to offer you, unfortunately, at that time.
If I could maybe take a moment of your time, and perhaps Justice Cherry give a little bit more, but I mean, just to illustrate the point about juvenile hall for high school students and all. I mean, I had a case when I was a trial judge in Las Vegas where six students were in juvenile hall and they were sent out to the freeway in the middle of the freeway to pick up trash and all, and they were out picking up trash, and a 19-year-old girl that was taking marijuana and ecstasy was driving down the freeway, and she fell asleep because of the drugs, and the six students were out there, and she ran into them and killed all six of them right in the middle of the freeway. Now, just because they were in juvenile hall, maybe they shouldn't have been out there on the freeway, but that's what happens, like that, and the parents probably thought it wasn't a big deal, probably thought it was good to have them in juvenile hall, and then they wound up dead. So things can happen, when you get into trouble at whatever age it is.
In White Pine County, we actually take extra measures to try and find rehabilitation programs for juveniles, because we believe at that stage in their life, that's when we can perhaps best affect them. Unfortunately, as with any rehabilitation, some make it, some don't. The same for drug court. With regards to some of the allegations made by the defendant with regards to Judge Pepez, he actually considered, the sentencing judge did consider the age of the appellant and his history, and he considered specifically stating that
he actually looked the defendant in the eye and heard the defendant talk to him.
Correct. The appellant, Mr. Harker, wrote a statement and then read that statement to the court. Nevada Revised Statutes 176.015 states that the court shall afford both counsel and the defendant the opportunity to address the court with regards to the sentence that they wish to receive in that case. Unfortunately, with regards to drug court, we do have mandates. There's a drug court team that meets, reviews the evaluations provided, and makes a determination as to whether an individual is an acceptable candidate. An individual who commits a first-time domestic violence may have problems getting in. In fact, there are actually funding and state and federal grants that go towards the drug court program that prevent certain individuals from entering those programs due to the violent issues.
Was Mr. Harker eligible to be sentenced as a habitual criminal if he was charged as such?
Yes, Your Honor, he was. In fact, that was part of the deal with the state, that he pled to two of the three felonies. While they were aggravated violent felonies, the state found it reasonable for him to plead to those, given that the state was not going to pursue habitual criminal charge against him. He was eligible for what we call the big habitual charge, which would mean he would be in prison for the rest of his life. The state gave him the opportunity to have a minimal sentence of 5 years and receive what the prison system has to offer. Our prison system is supposed to be a rehabilitation. It is for punishment and rehabilitation. There are programs in the prison system designed to assist these people. However, when individuals continue to commit crimes, as the sentencing judge said, felony after felony after felony, violent crimes that hurt people in our community, the community cries out for people like this to be put away, then the habitual criminal statute kicks in, and they go away for the rest of their lives because they are not deemed.
It's interesting. I know Justice Cherry and I have a case out in Pahrump where a man had committed many, many crimes and convicted, and he's kind of violent, and he went in to see his girlfriend coming out of a beauty salon. She was getting her nails done, and she came out. He was mad at her, so he spit in her face, and they went out and threw a brick in her windshield. And that was after a long list of crimes, and the judge got fed up, and the judge sentenced him to life in prison for for spitting at his girlfriend and throwing a brick in her windshield. So we had that case on appeal. We're going to have to decide it, but he got sentenced to prison for the rest of his life. So things like that can happen with habitual criminals.
In light of what Justice Gibbons has said about habitual criminal, why won't the DA pursue habitual criminal if this guy's so bad? I mean, Mr. Borman's telling us, you know, at age 44, maybe he's reached the end of the line and he needed drug court or rehabilitation. And you had an opportunity to put him away forever. If he's so violent and not eligible for drug court, why don't you pursue the habitual criminal?
In order to make certain cases proceed in a more efficient manner, or where there are witnesses that may not be the most effective witnesses, or there may be some flaws in the case, then the state will make offers to the defense in order to get the best conviction it can out of the case. Sometimes there may be issues with a motion to search, a search warrant, et cetera, or the way the officers investigated the case. And the state reviews all of the evidence and all of the witnesses when making a determination as to whether or not to go forward on all the charges. And we also, sometimes an efficiency, maybe not in this case particularly, but other cases where we give you one of the two felonies and we go forward in that fashion.
If everybody went to trial, the system would break down. So plea bargaining is part of the American criminal justice system.
And in fact, the issues here with regards to whether or not the sentencing judge did abuse his discretion, an example of when a judge may abuse his discretion, there was a case out of Clark County, and I believe I have that here, which was Norwood versus State, where the individual had been pled guilty to robbery with a deadly weapon, a similar case here, and the sentencing judge heard all the information provided, and then, in essence, made up the own facts in his head. He stated, well, gosh, you're a gang member. You look like a gang member to me, and sentenced him using that information. And that information was not in the record. It was not presented by either party. And Your Honors determined that that was abuse of discretion.
Now, that wasn't Justice Gibbons or me, was it?
No, I believe not. That would be your court.
Sure.
And that was in Las Vegas. The case that would be relevant here, as cited by the appellant, would be Denson versus State. And that is a case that we rely on when we try to argue these type of cases. And this case states that very few limitations are imposed on a sentencing judge's right to consider evidence in making a sentence. In fact, while we all prefer the judge to take into consideration all factors involved, the sentencing judge can also take into consideration crimes that were not charged, as well as the statement from a victim, et cetera. In this case, the judge focused primarily on the record, everything that was in the pre-sentence investigation, the history. In essence, the defendant, the appellant in this case, made his own bed, and now he's going to be sleeping in it in the Nevada Department of Corrections. And we would request that the court consider all the evidence presented and uphold the sentence and not reverse today. And if you have any further questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lorman, Ms. Pickering, for your informative and educational arguments in this matter. This case will stand submitted, Ms. Cummings. And I think that both these attorneys deserve a round of applause for their participation.